Monday, March 7th, 2005. We are hearing House Bill 5057, the Oregon Department of State Police, and we'll just be at ease for a couple of minutes here. Quorum this afternoon, and I need to note that Senator Devlin is ill. Senator Winters will not be with us. I will ask our legislative fiscal analyst, Mr. Wilson, to offer a few comments before we turn to the department.
Madam Chair, just a note to the subcommittee members at your table or desk or whatever, there's a new priority list which I think will meet what you needed. The third, and it's also on bigger paper, or bigger print. The first page is basically what you saw that they went through a week ago. The next page, and I guess it's really the next two pages, is really what I think Representative Hannah was asking for, which takes the same groupings that are on the first page in that same priority order for the budget that's there. This is similar to what we've had before. And then the back, and that's the agency-wide, and then the remaining pages from page four is the division-by-division priority list in a little bit more detail. So I think that's what folks are used to. My suggestion to the agency was that when they completed their going through their overview again, to probably return here after you've heard about each division and each bureau and come back and go through this to make sure that you sort of, if there are any outstanding questions on what they have as a priority, you can. So this is replaces what's in your notebook now and what I hope can be used in the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. And now we turn to our agency overview, and with us we have, please identify yourselves for the record.
I'm Major Dan Durbin.
Please turn the microphone as close to you as you can. Okay. And Major, you will be presenting
yes,
the majority of the presentation. Okay, very good. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Major Dan Durbin, the Operations Services Bureau Commander. Just a quick word about myself, my history. I've spent 24 of the last 25 years in the field as a patrol trooper, a narcotics detective, a drug task force commander, colonel division lieutenant, and a patrol office station commander before relocating to Salem to work as the patrol division commander and now as the Operations Services Bureau Commander. Now, by command structure, I answer directly to the operations lieutenant colonel who reports directly to the superintendent. The department is divided into two bureaus, the Operations Services Bureau and the Support Services Bureau. The Operations Services Bureau includes the Patrol Division, the Criminal Division, and the Fish and Wildlife Divisions. Now, the state is divided into three regions, the Northwest Region, the Southwest Region, and the East Region. The three regions include 18 area commands and 22 work sites with troopers assigned to one or the other. An area command is a larger city office that typically includes one or more work sites and encompasses one or more counties. A work site is a satellite office to the area command, such as Government Camp to Portland, Gold Beach to Coos Bay, Prineville and Madras to Bend, or Grants Pass to Central Point. I plan to present a brief overview of each of the three divisions, including the program overview, service delivery, and performance measures. I intend to present the Criminal Division first, followed by Fish and Wildlife Division, and then ending with the Patrol Division. If you would please refer to page 11 of the handout, that's where the testimony begins for the Criminal Division. The Governor's recommended budget.
This, Madam Chair, is under the Bureau present preparation tab. Page 11.
The Governor's recommended budget provides for 135 full-time criminal investigation positions assigned to various locations statewide. I've included an organizational chart of the division with your handout. It follows the numbered pages. Page 52 is the numbered pages that you have there. Each region is supervised by a lieutenant who reports directly to the division director. Now, of the 135 full-time positions, 22 are assigned to responsibilities other than criminal investigations, such as Capitol Mall, Dignitary Protection, and Homeland Security. 33 of these positions are professional staff assigned to Sex Offender Registration, Investigative Support Unit, the Investigative Records Section and Data Entry, the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program, and Administrative Support Staff. The remaining 81 positions are sworn employees that are assigned to various locations in the state for criminal investigations, drug enforcement, arson and explosives, tobacco tax enforcement, and program operational oversight. Now, the purpose of the division is to provide specialized investigative services to support the criminal justice agency statewide through innovative programs and highly trained, dedicated personnel. Our goal is to provide an exceptional level of investigative support and expertise to local and federal enforcement agencies in the state. The Criminal Investigation Division has five main investigative sections and one support section. Now, those investigative sections are the Major Crime Section, the Drug Enforcement Section, the Arson Explosive Section, the Office of Public Safety and Security, and the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. The Investigative Report Section maintains oversight of the criminal police reports for this agency, and this includes such things as investigative report entry into our database, expungement and sealed orders, and public records requests, and the Oregon Uniform Crime Report requirements. Statewide, local, and federal law enforcement agencies are supported by these programs and specialized services provided by the division. Now, as an example, in 2004, it processed more than 1,500 seal orders, more than 2,300 expungement orders, and almost 1,700 public records requests.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilstadt.
Thank you. Could you, I don't know, what's a sponge? And,
when records are expunged, ordered expunged by the court.
Yeah. And you had another, Major, you had another the term you used. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with it. Thank God I haven't been involved in these.
Expungement and sealed orders.
Please, yes.
That when the orders are, again, those records are ordered sealed by the courts. Expunged, cleared, or sealed.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Please continue.
Thank you. So what you're doing, it's entry, data entry, or things like that, or it's not, you're not having to go out and get something, or an officer's not deployed. It's within your administrative and computers section, Major?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisner, that's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe, Doug, you're going to have to help with this, but with this, where we're starting with the Criminal Investigation Division, can you help us line item that to the budget sheet for the agency? Because I think, Major Durbin, you started out with 130-some folks. Is that right?
Madam Chair,
within that?
Representative, that's correct.
And when I try to...
It's 135. Is that the number?
Yes.
And when I try to come back to that on the budget sheet, I see 94. So I must not. Is it a total of lines?
Right, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna. If you take a look at this chart, I think you'll find. I'm looking at on this time the second page of what I.
Yeah.
You'll see the majority of them. I think is your 94 on line 6.
Right.
But then you go further down because it has multiple programs and they prioritize. You'll see something on line 13, the Office of Public Safety and Security. Line 14, which is sex offender registration.
Okay, I'm following. So you're just going to, we're totaling all the criminal together, and that's going to
right, because it is a separate administrative unit, but within that unit there's numerous programs, and they have prioritized various portions of those.
Madam Chair, if I may, for the record, my name is Ken Weiss, Budget Director. Representative Hanna, on page 6 of 12 of that big document has all of the criminal division programs and their priorities and their total budget along with the 135 positions.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Major, before you proceed, to clarify, under the drug enforcement section, is that where we would find the meth-related enforcement activities, those that are planned and those that may be currently taking place?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Under the Office of Public Safety and Security, in parentheses, Homeland Security, how many positions are in that office?
There are five, Madam Chair.
And of those five, are those all investigators, or what are those positions?
There is currently one supervisor and four detectives.
Madam Chair, that office is slightly different from the others in terms of the organization, because actually in the governor's budget, and this is where you have the parenthetically Homeland Security,
yes,
the general fund for that office is in the Office of Homeland Security, and then they contract with the state police and the Office of Public Safety and Security to provide those services. So in terms of, they're sworn officers, but really they have a tie to the Office of Homeland Security. In this case,
is it accurate to say that, Mr. Wilson, is it accurate to say that they are they're housed at the Oregon State Police, assigned to Homeland Security, or is it assigned to Homeland Security, housed at the Oregon State Police? Just trying to understand the clear distinctions here.
I'm really, Madam Chair, not sure how to characterize it. Maybe someone from the governor's office or from the agency can figure out which one best characterizes it.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Ken Lewis, budget director. The program is set up under contract, interagency agreement between the state police and the Office of Homeland Security, for the state police to provide security services, intelligence services to the Homeland Security. The officers remain employees of ours. They have an office in one of our field offices. I think it's on the Hawthorne address here in Salem. But they will interact daily with the Office of Homeland Security operations.
And so the supervisor, the person supervising those four detectives, who does that supervisor report to? Is it someone in the Office of Homeland Security, or is that person reporting to the someone in the Oregon State Police?
Madam Chair, if I can make a correction, there are two supervisors assigned to the unit and three detectives. Now, position, the lead supervisor acts also as a deputy director for the Office of Homeland Security and answers directly to the division director in the criminal division as well.
So the deputy director of Homeland Security is housed at the Oregon State Police.
Yes.
And that deputy director of Homeland Security is also one of the two supervisors, one of the two supervisors supervising three detectives?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
The deputy director of Homeland Security, I'm assuming that that person has some other responsibilities, some other supervisory responsibilities, or some other responsibilities that that person is carrying the title deputy.
Are you, Madam Chair, are you making reference to the responsibilities for the agency?
That's what I'm trying to clarify. If there are additional responsibilities for the agency, meaning the Oregon State Police, or if there are other responsibilities for that deputy with the Office of Homeland Security.
Would you like to respond?
Yes. Madam Chair, for the record, Captain Ed Murray, Criminal Investigation Division Director, member of the committee. Hopefully I can answer some of these questions. The Office of Public Safety and Security is now housed within my division, Criminal Investigation Division. It has a lieutenant, a sergeant, three detectives. I have one detective assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force up in Portland. I have one detective right now dedicated to domestic terrorism on the ALF issues. Third detective is vacant right now. I have a sergeant currently who oversees a lot of the critical threat assessment statewide and the terrorism issues in preparation and identifying threats around the state. As far as the deputy director's position will be a lieutenant, we just finished processing and doing an interview of that. We have not announced that position yet. That lieutenant reports to me as it relates to state police functions on the law enforcement side. Naturally, this piece works intricately with the Oregon Department of Justice Criminal Intelligence Unit with the Terrorism Fusion Center right now. The deputy director position also will report to the Department of Homeland Security director, pretty much on keeping advisements that come out of the National Homeland Security Office. In Homeland Security, you have an investigative piece, you have a response piece, and a preparation piece. So we're kind of more or less the law enforcement liaison piece in conjunction with the Department of Justice.
At some point, it would be helpful to see a configuration on paper that shows the placement of these different staff roles and functions and where they intersect. I'm still not clear on, and I appreciate you trying to unpack this for me, but I'm still not clear on that deputy function. Is it the deputy? Does that deputy report to the, is it Beverly?
Stillwell, yes, Madam Chair.
So that's her deputy?
As it relates to Homeland Security Operations.
Well, someone back there is nodding no, so which one is it?
It's our employee, but it's assigned to her.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, he is our employee, but assigned to her.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, and please correct me if wrong, one of the issues here is they wanted a law enforcement sworn officer in these positions, and the state superintendent has that ability for having sworn officers. The director, at this time at least, the director of Homeland Security does not. So that is one of the reasons for that this particular arrangement. I think I mentioned a week ago that it may be helpful if, when we get to Homeland Security around that time, to make sure that, and this may be something for Mr. Campbell to come in and sort of discuss the interaction between Homeland Security, State Police, as well as the Department of Justice, all of which have responsibilities not only in Homeland Security but also in criminal investigations and things, to make sure this subcommittee sort of understands the role in each case in each agency.
Mm-hmm. And in my line of questioning, members and to the department, has everything to do with wanting to understand if the roles and functions have the enhancements that are required to get the job done or not. So help us unpack that information as we go along. Representative Hannah.
Well, my question relates to how it fits in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
This employee works for you. Does their salary get paid back by the federal funds coming back for Homeland Security?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, we have an intergovernmental agreement with the Office of Homeland Security where they actually will get general funds appropriated in their budget. They're requesting general funds. They will take that money and, under this intergovernmental agreement, pay us for services that we provide for those officers so that we can essentially, we'll pay for the salaries of the people.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So it'll come back as other funds because it's from one department to the other.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, yes.
May I follow up one more time?
Certainly.
So is the public safety and security, the terrorism piece, is that part of it as well, or is that separate?
I hate to keep playing musical chairs, but allow me to have Captain Mallory answer that question.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, hopefully if I followed your question right, is it the terrorism piece? Yeah, the Office of Public Safety is the one that I mentioned that has a detective assigned to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. We work closely with DOJ Intel. We work in conjunction with regular law enforcement. Referring back to the Madam Chair's question as far as the assets and stuff, I think this is in my division, and this entity can go ahead and contact any of my field lieutenants which I have some people who are assigned to what's called field investigative team that the FBI has. When something comes up out in the field, we contact that person to investigate the issue further. So this unit really works closely within my division as far as if there's a need for resources, what we do is divert either a narcotics detective, if it's a surveillance type mission, or a regular criminal investigator that may work with an FBI agent out in the field at the Medford Bend type office.
I want to follow up one more time.
Yes.
I still want to make sure that I understand the terrorism piece that's in the criminal division budget is not tied to the Homeland Security piece then.
Yes, it is. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Hammond, yes, it is. Yes, the easiest way to draw it would be is this entity sits within my division as far as on the OSP role of being able to use State Police Criminal Investigation Division resources, patrol, whatever, and acts as liaison, but also interacts with the Department of Homeland Security over here as a law enforcement liaison on, you know, if we get terrorism briefs, those types of level. In the terrorism world today, working with the federal government, obviously there are security clearances on what information can be released and can't be released. And we have to make some decisions as working with other law enforcement agencies, what's classified, what's declassified. So we're kind of the liaison that it sits within the DHS, but also it has the access to my division on any operational needs.
There are two positions under terrorism, Office of Homeland Security, terrorism.
Madam Chair, actually, you're looking at the first page is the list of cuts.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a look, go to the second page, that is the list of the total budget, and there are a total of five positions and roughly $1 million.
So these are the same five positions,
right,
that you...
That's correct.
That's okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Well, I'll just follow up. I think the better page to look at is actually on the handwritten 6 of 12, because it goes specifically somebody pointed that out to us, and that part's good. So then, and this goes back to the budget, the $1 million of other funds comes from where? $1,028,000. It shows up as other funds, but it comes from?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management, the roughly $1 million comes from the Oregon Homeland Security, the proposed agency in the governor's recommended budget called Oregon Homeland Security. So that money is appropriated to Oregon Homeland Security. Oregon Homeland Security then pays Oregon State Police.
Thank you. That helps. So if we approve Homeland Security, this is where that funding comes from.
That's correct.
Great. Thank you.
I think we have sufficiently unpacked that piece of luggage. Let's go on to the next one.
The major crime section is the main investigative branch of the division. The supervisors and detectives participate in multidisciplinary child abuse and major crime investigation teams that are fixed around the state. The detectives perform a wide range of investigations, including homicide and death investigation, crimes involving violence, state institution crimes, major fraud and theft crimes, internal criminal investigations of other law enforcement or government agencies upon request, officer-involved shootings, threat assessments, elder abuse, and homeland security investigations. Now, specialized investigative services supporting law enforcement also include forensic computer crime analysts and polygraph. The investigative support unit programs provide support for the Criminal Investigation Division and local law enforcement. These programs are the Homicide Investigation Tracking System. This is a tri-state major crime database that provides tracking and analysis of individual and serial violent crime offenders, the unidentified deceased records, and crime analysts who are available to support major crime teams and the district attorney's offices by providing crime analysis and investigative support, crime scene assistance, computerized recreations in three-dimensional still images or animated videos, and access to a multitude of databases to assist in locating suspects, supporting threat assessments, and officer safety bulletins. Now, this unit is also the state contact for what we refer to as Interpol, that stands for International Police Liaison, and the secondary state contact for FinCEN, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. The Missing Children's Clearinghouse coordinates the recovery of abducted children and is linked to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. We also provide Amber Alert telephone tip line coordination center support to local law enforcement agencies that do not have the resources to staff these tip line centers. From March 2003 through November 2004, there has been 9 Amber Alerts that resulted in the recovery of 10 children in Oregon. The Sex Offender Registration Unit provides a statewide computerized repository for sex offender records and serves public safety agencies by monitoring and tracking over 10,000 registered sex offenders. The Drug Enforcement Section currently has detectives that are assigned to 3 local drug task forces and 4 federal drug task forces in the state. At times, the detectives will work in undercover capacity depending upon the investigation. The section monitors the sale and transfer of precursor chemicals related to the manufacture of methamphetamine from businesses. Most of the detectives are also certified clandestine laboratory site safety officers, which are responsible for dismantling methamphetamine labs, seizing evidence for prosecution, and they coordinate the removal of toxic chemicals from the lab sites. They have 1 drug detection dog that is available to assist drug task forces or patrol officers in searching for concealed drugs in Southern Oregon.
Major, we have a question from Representative Hansen.
Yeah, sorry to keep moving backwards. On the Amber Alert telephone tip line coordination center, do you only coordinate some of the state or places where there's not local phone-in ability?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, that's true. That's upon request.
Okay.
Based upon the resources that are available.
Of the 9 that came in, how many came in on state lines?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm trying to answer the question is that came in on state lines, the actual Amber Alert request to launch one. Usually those come in, if I'm getting to your question, at times the state will be requested to launch an Amber Alert for Washington or California based on the nature of their investigation initiated the persons into Oregon. And it's off the top of my head, I'm thinking probably of those 9 that we launched. Excuse me for a moment, and I'll take a look and see if I've got that information here real quick. Those 9 are, let's see, we had 1 that was requested out of Mount Vernon, Washington. We had 1 that was requested from the California Highway Patrol, so 2 of the 9 were out-of-state requests.
Okay, thank you.
Before we, Representative Hanna, I'd like to stay on this page 12 as well for a minute. The state institution crimes, how many open cases are there currently?
I don't have that information in front of you, but I can get that information for you, Madam Chair.
If you would, please, in terms of how many cases, which institutions, let's start there. Okay. Please continue.
The high-intensity drug trafficking area program are regions that are designated by the Office of National Drug Control Policy that have critical drug trafficking problems which may impact other parts of the state or nation. Now, the department is a pass-through agency for federal funds with this program, and Oregon has 7 such designated counties. This is a joint effort of federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies who work together to assess regional drug threats, to design strategies to combat the threats, and to develop initiatives to implement those strategies.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnot and then Representative Hanna.
I'd be interested in knowing which counties those are. Major, do you have those? The counties are identified. See, those are my backyard. Deschutes County.
I can't quote them all.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, the 7 hydro-drug counties, if you ask for Deschutes, Jackson, Douglas,
Marion, and the three metro area counties, which are Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
You mentioned that, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that, that it's pass-through money. So are all of those going to a DENT-style team within the counties that are mentioned?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. I think out of that, it funds part of the HIDA/DOJ intel center that we have, and then each county that launches some type of enforcement initiative, it is distributed amongst those requirements.
And a follow-up. And realizing that your priority list is difficult to come together, is that why that's the lowest priority? It is pass-through funds. You're not keeping it within the agency?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. It's all federal pass-through funds. Thank you.
Could you share with us what qualifies as a high-intensity drug trafficking area, and then also which drugs are you seeing as a part of this enforcement?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the HIDAs are designated by the Office of National Drug Control Policy out of Washington, D.C. A lot of it, when Oregon became a HIDA in 1999, we applied, and a lot of our congressional delegation lobbied back there to get Oregon or parts of Oregon designated as a HIDA. That's based on usually a threat assessment that's done on an individual county. There are some are six-state HIDAs, like in the Midwest has a six-state HIDAs. A lot of it's based on the threat criteria of what was occurring at the time in Oregon. The first three we had were Jackson, Marion, and Deschutes for the first three. The metro area, I believe, and Douglas were added next, the next four, like a year or two after on that.
And the drugs involved are what?
The drugs can be anything. It just, excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the drugs can be anything. It depends on what the initiative is for. Perhaps Representative Hanna, the DENT team right now has a huge marijuana initiative based on some of the outdoor grows that have been seen down Douglas County with some major organizations. The ones that are up in the metro area, we tend to see a lot of the cocaine, more heroin-driven, and meth as well. Marion Deschutes, I think we see in Jackson County, pretty much meth-driven. So a lot of it comes down to local law enforcement comes together to draft a threat assessment, put a strategy together, and say this is what we're going to do if we were able to get HIDA funds, and that has to be approved back in Washington, D.C., as well as the Executive Board.
And so marijuana, that's one category. Crack cocaine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this point in time, I've just only seen powder cocaine. I haven't seen anything specifically in crack. But a HIDA could be used, HIDA funds could be used for ecstasy. It's whatever drugs in particular that designation sees fit. The threat assessments can change as well depending on the demographics of the user or what they believe the distribution problem is.
And as I understand it, we've not used this designation for methamphetamine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in some of the enforcement initiatives, methamphetamine is listed as an enforcement initiative. Jackson County, Deschutes, Marion. I believe there's a couple of initiatives out of the metro area that list meth, heroin, and cocaine. Some of the organizations that we deal in and work aren't specifically related to one type of drug. They're a polydrug organization, so they may deal on all three. It's just that methamphetamine has kind of inundated us on everything else.
I'm sorry, methamphetamine is
has
what?
Has inundated the state and everything else.
Okay.
Chair, real quick.
Yeah.
Major, and are we getting everything we can from the feds? Can we get more? Is this, and how, you know, did this go up from last year? And are we, you know, because of our problems in the state, the high trafficking, can we get any more?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, right now, with that, the HIDA, once they plateau out, it's going to be depending up to Congress what they set that HIDA budget is at. If they do give more drugs, then it's pretty much spread. Everybody's on the fight on the table to put together a threat assessment asking for a bigger piece of the pie. I started the actual HIDA as interim director, and we started out like $600,000 a year. I believe we're up to $2.7 million a year right now is what HIDA funds come in at. We just had a recent increase probably 2 years ago of $250,000 on top of the $2.5 million. So there are chances for increase. There's chances for decreases depending on if Miami, Florida seems to be the hot spot. Oregon just doesn't come up on the radar screen very high. So it's the federal people back in D.C. pretty much dictate how much each of the HIDAs are going to get.
Thank you.
And so it's up to Congress to determine whether or not methamphetamine gets included as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Congress, you know, depending if they wanted to put some federal funds aside for, like, I think we've had some of the Congressional or the Federal Methamphetamine Act type of deal. As far as for HIDA, if ONDCP asked for more funds specifically to address the methamphetamine issue, that could happen. But again, there's a lot of review and stuff going on back there right now with the presidential budget right now that is kind of in a flurry of the burn funds, HIDA funds, and so forth.
That's very helpful. Please continue, Major.
The governor's recommended budget provides for a methamphetamine task force staffed by 9 full-time employees. That includes 1 sergeant, 7 detectives, and a forensic scientist. The task force will target persons who are trafficking in precursor chemicals used to manufacture methamphetamine. The goal is to provide intelligence and investigation to locate and dismantle clandestine labs. Several performance objectives being considered will include the tracking of arrests, children removed from dangerous chemical environments, labs dismantled, precursors removed, and federal diversion cases on out-of-compliance stores. Detectives assigned to the arson and explosives section determine fire cause. They assist other law enforcement and fire agencies with the investigation of arson fires, which are often started to cover other crimes, including such things as burglary, murder, and insurance fraud. Many law enforcement agencies in the state do not have the expertise or experience to conduct arson investigations, so we provide 1 arson accelerant detection canine to assist fire services around the state, as well as respond to national incidents upon request by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We did have another canine who was just recently retired. The dog that is currently assigned is to a detective in the Portland area. Our explosive unit is available to respond to calls to render safe explosive devices, as well as to provide a service to the public in disposal of found explosives. We also conduct post-blast investigations as a result of an explosive device. During 2003 and 2004, the explosive unit responded to more than 500 call-outs across the state. The Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force was formed by the 2001 legislative session to address the problems of criminal noncompliance with Oregon's tobacco taxes, with an emphasis on investigations that involve significant cigarette traffickers or organizations that sell, distribute, or import cigarettes in violation of Oregon law. Now, this task force is a cooperative effort with the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon Department of Revenue, and works cohesively with the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the United States Attorney's Office.
I have to say, it's the first time I've ever heard of a dog being retired from service. We won't ask you about the benefits that go along with the retirement package.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, is it just drawing purse?
No. In May of 2004, the governor signed Executive Order Number 04-05 that created the Office of Homeland Security. The Office of Homeland Security brought together components of Oregon government to work to address domestic and international security issues. Those agencies that are directly or indirectly working with the Office of Homeland Security include the Office of Emergency Management, the Criminal Justice Services Division, the Office of State Fire Marshal, the Oregon National Guard, and it liaisons with the Department of Agriculture, Transportation, Environmental Quality, and the Department of Human Services Public Health Preparedness Section.
What you're reading to us now is information that we don't have in text form. It would be good to see that description as soon as possible. Again, we're trying to get our arms around the relationship of the Oregon State Police to the new Office of Homeland Security. If you have a document that describes and defines what the Oregon State Police function looks like, that would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, I have that, and I can provide that very soon.
Thank you.
The Oregon State Police Office of Public Safety and Security provides a state law enforcement liaison to the Office of Homeland Security. Working in partnership with various local, state, and federal criminal justice agencies and private sector entities that are part of Oregon's infrastructure. Nationwide, terrorism fusion centers are being formed in each state. Now, the purpose of the fusion center is to provide connectivity of a vast array of information that is funneled in a coordinated center that can evaluate potential threats related to domestic and international terrorism. This is accomplished through effective coordination of information and investigations with various local, state, and federal entities. Across the state, detectives are primarily assigned to the same work sites and area commands shared by members from the Patrol and Fish and Wildlife Divisions. Division detectives participate in various interagency task forces or teams in each local community, as well as the various advisory or policy boards that division members attend with law enforcement partners. Now, examples of some of those task forces are the Child Sex Abuse Multidisciplinary Teams, Major Crime Team, Drug Enforcement Task Forces, and the Interagency Fire Investigation Teams. As a statewide law enforcement agency, we have the ability to mobilize resources for major criminal investigations. This can be things such as police officer-involved shootings, major criminal investigations involving another public government agency, or a major criminal crime incident requiring extensive resources in a short period of time. It's fairly common that detectives carry a caseload outside their primary investigative assignment. For instance, a detective that is assigned to a multidisciplinary child abuse team who primarily investigates child abuse cases may also serve on the major crime team. Now, that same detective may also be assigned to conduct internal criminal investigations of other law enforcement or local government entities upon their request. Major crime section detectives have also assisted our drug enforcement detectives on a drug case where resources are limited in a community and vice versa. Detectives are also responsible for criminal investigations in state institutions such as the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Oregon State Hospital. And I just made a note of this. Last year, detectives investigated 180 new institution crimes in Marion County alone. They worked on another 150 institution cases that were open from previous years, and I will follow that up and get the numbers of cases statewide as requested. The division has one performance measure. If you refer to page 15 of your handout, it has a performance measure as well as a graph. We determine the percent of major crime team callouts that are resolved within 12 months from the date of the callout. The goal is linked to benchmark 61, or the overall reported crimes per 1,000 Oregonians. The target rate was 70% for 2002 through 2005 and is raised to 75% for 2006-2007. The agency target is to continue to close major cases at not less than the baseline for the prior year's closure rates and to increase that rate of closure. That goal was achieved during this last biennium. The overall reported crimes for Oregon gives a perspective as to community livability and safety, types of serious crime reported in Oregon, and whether or not they are on the increase or the decrease. Solvability of major crimes gives a perspective that law enforcement is working together to keep the public safe, and that those who commit violent crimes will be held accountable and prosecuted. Page 17 of your handout shows two additional graphs that detail the number of major crime team call-outs per region as well as their respective resolution rates. For example, there were 49 major crime team call-outs in 2003, with 46 closed by arrest for a resolution rate of 94%. The majority of those crimes investigated are homicides, but also include suspicious deaths, aggravated assaults, attempted murders, kidnap, officer-involved shootings, and sexual assaults. During 2004, there were 41 major crime team call-outs with 37 cases cleared. The Brooke Wilberger case remains one of the four open cases to date. The division has also conducted 79 public official misconduct investigations during 2003 and 2004. The division provides a very important safety net for many
local law enforcement agencies that do not have the expertise and resources to address these types of investigations. The goal is to quickly and efficiently investigate and resolve crimes against Oregonians. Currently, the division has detectives assigned to 28 major crime teams. Now, in addition to providing detectives to these major crime teams, the division provides teams with numerous specialized investigative resources that include some of the things already discussed, such as the Missing Children's Clearinghouse, criminal analysts, polygraphers, the Sex Offender Registration Unit, forensic computer examiners, arson investigators, and crime reconstructions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's impressive, major impressive numbers, and I guess a good benchmark, too. Can you tell us how many polygraph people you have and how many forensic computer examiners, and have you looked at contracting out? Do you have enough workload to keep those guys, you know, gainfully employed at all times? And the same thing, the arson investigation, how does that work? Don't we have a state fire chief, and does he have capabilities? He depend upon your investigators, and are they, you know, also fire trained?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the first part, polygraphers and the computer forensics. I have 5 polygraphers right now statewide. I used to have 7. And on the computer forensics detectives, I used to have 4. I'm down to 2. You know, on the polygraph deal right now, we do quite a bit. Polygraph is an art that leads to a lot of confessions, and it's as, depending on how good that person is at doing an interview and using a polygraph machine, you do have a pretty good.
My brother-in-law is a polygraph expert, defense intelligence.
That. And the new access thing is, I believe you've heard probably the voice stress analyzer come out. Some people are migrating to that. It's our belief right now we're pretty comfortable with the way the polygraph. We just updated our unit with state-of-the-art laptop computers and these ways you can indicate whether a person's trying to defeat the polygraph. There's seat cushions they sit on and all sorts of things. So we have upgraded that. Our bang for the buck as far as what we get with doing the other agencies, we get a lot of requests. In fact, there are some requests that we're have to turn down. I have one polygrapher now that just went through a hip replacement and he's due to come back. So that shut me down in the metro area, which means I had to have a Springfield person kind of pick up some stuff on like a very major type case. Priority cases when law enforcement asks for it, we send a polygrapher, a major death investigation or homicide or missing person. Computer crimes, I have one person detailed right now to the FBI's brand new Northwest Regional Computer Forensics Lab. It's a state-of-the-art lab up in Portland. Right now, my other one is based here in Salem. He does enough work with just on state agencies getting hacked and everything else, so these guys are pretty busy, sometimes 4 to 6 month caseload backlog. The second part of your question,
arson.
The Office of State Fire Marshal's Office, deputy fire marshals have administrative powers only, not criminal powers. So a lot of times when they respond, we work in conjunction with them. If it's an accidental fire or a fire that involves a fatality, they will call us because, as you know, some people who commit crimes will use arson to cover and burn up the evidence. So a lot of the fatalities, fires, we do go and review with the deputy state fire marshals. Again, they have administrative powers, subpoena powers only. They can't do search warrants, apply for search warrants, stuff like that. So our guys do the law enforcement criminal piece of that investigation.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The only question, I think, very thank you for that information. You gave me a good rundown. But so you talked about a lot of backlog. Have you in the past used contract polygraphers or computer examinations? Is that something we're going to be needing in the future as our crimes increase?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, I can't think of law enforcement right now that has contracted out because of some of the legal issues using a contract polygrapher, somebody makes a confession type of deal. Most law enforcement around here, at least my knowledge, have pretty much kept their own polygraph services to use that. As far as computer forensics, that's another deal right now. I think computer forensics are coming out with what I believe is called an ASCLAD. The FBI is certified. There is a huge certification process for these people to go through. When you get down to having to contract that out, you get into evidence custody. If I take this computer and I get to a private citizen type of deal, that becomes an issue. What that private citizen has, or excuse that private party who does computer forensics, what type of facilities they have to really keep the evidence custody. So we've never really gone to that because of some of those legal issues.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Could you comment again on in what areas you do have a backlog? What type of cases? Which of your professionals are either at capacity or not able to keep up with the demand? Can you give us even more detail on what that picture looks like?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll try to. As far as the record section you heard about that does the expungement and seals, we did some swapping, just added a couple of FTE internally, and now we're back up to, at one point in time, we were 6 months backlog on just public records requests on records, and now we're pretty much up to within a 2-3 day turnaround type. We had to change some procedures and protocols on how we did things and got a little bit more efficient. So we're pretty good in that retrospect. As far as on the investigation side, when you take reductions, you do have impacts. The computer forensics deal, we try to prioritize which are your top-of-the-meat cases. Obviously, child pornography, those types of cases that we get, mm-hmm. if it involves a government official type of deal, we try to prioritize. So, honestly, to tell you, the detectives out there in all my sections pretty much just do a juggling every day. It's depending which plate's really wobbling on the stick that we go over and jump to that one, and you drop this other investigation and jump to this one. I can tell you my detectives in the Salem office are critically overloaded. We should probably have about 8 to 9 FTE in that office right now. But as far as that goes, we have what it is when you keep getting assigned cases, the question is, do you open the case? Does the case sit there till you get a chance to do the initial assessment? You know, I think on some detective's desk, you'll see some cases that were assigned based on a crime. It's a lower priority crime, so that kind of sits. We have these other ones that are kind of continually working when you can get to a witness, a suspect type of deal. Then you've got these other ones, what we call critical, or like your major crime team call-outs, a homicide, sex abuse, those things, where the priority of a child is in danger that we have to respond to now. So that's kind of the case management, what we go through on a day-by-day basis.
So you should have 8 to 9 FTE, you said, in the Salem area, but you have what?
I have, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe I have a sergeant and 6 detectives and 1 forensics computer detective and 1 narcotics officer. So yeah, as far as just general law investigations, I have 6. And, of course, right now I have a vacancy due to a promotion, so I'm down to 5. So, of course, that makes the caseload even more difficult because mm-hmm. you're down 1 okay. temporarily.
Okay. Please continue.
Madam Chair, that concludes the testimony for the criminal division. And if there are not additional questions, I'm prepared to move into the Fish and Wildlife Division.
Other questions, Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't need the answers now, but maybe before we get into page 2. The types of things I'm interested in the criminal division, as you were going over the different kinds of activities, some of them seem to be involved with record data entry. I guess I'm interested in how many of those really require, whether they're being done by sworn personnel or clerical positions, and if I could get a breakdown of that later. How many sworn personnel do you have involved in I guess the informational type issues?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I think we can answer that right now. There are no sworn positions that are in that role at this time.
The other thing I'd be interested in seeing would be in the breakout on the like on the major crime team call-outs, especially like in the Northwest region, how many of those overlap in the metro area with Portland Police, Washington and Clackamas County officers?
Madam Chair, I can probably answer that pretty much. PPB, Portland Police Bureau, I think we just recently got requested to serve on the major crime team on the last officer-involved shooting piece. Normally, we don't do a lot with Portland Police Bureau. Clackamas County has a major crime team. Multnomah County has a major crime team, as does Washington County. A lot of it depends on if they decide to do a major crime team call out. Depends on, I think they look at the resources they have. Like in Washington County, realistically, doesn't need to do a major crime team call out because they have enough resources they can do it. So some of those detectives up there, I may have one that actually works on two major crime teams, Washington and Clackamas, because it's a far and few type of deal. Clackamas, the latest one, I think we were up there. We do quite a few in Clackamas. I would say out of the three metro area counties, we do probably Multnomah and Clackamas more than we do Washington on major crime team call-outs when the DA requests it. DA Foote oftentimes will request a major crime team call-out automatically with an officer involved shooting.
Okay, so on those 17 in the Northwest region, if I can get the breakout of where those came from, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative, we'll look at that for you. Okay.
And then also, Major, I had asked that you come back with information on the number of state institution crimes. In addition to the number, also indicate which institutions are involved, and then also what type of case is it? Is that?
Madam Chair, members, things we can do that. I'll probably take a handful count because I don't have an automated system to do it. But if your definition of an open case, to be clarified, is how many cases that are open
that you're working on right now?
Just working on. Okay, some that are kind of just stagnant, some that we're continuing as a lump pulse, just a whole type of picture.
I'm interested in current,
okay.
Current cases.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. And also, please give our best to the superintendent. He was struggling when he was here the other day. We hope he's feeling better.
Yes. Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to introduce and invite Captain Bruce Karn, who is the Fish and Wildlife Division Captain, sit with me at the table during this part of the presentation.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Karn, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division.
Can you spell your last name, please?
It's spelled C-A-R-N-E.
Thank you. And please start whenever you like.
If you would refer to page 18 of your handout, the governor's recommended budget provides for 119 full-time fish and wildlife troopers assigned to various locations statewide and one professional staff person at general headquarters. There is also an organizational chart after the numbered pages, if you care to look at that. The purpose of the Fish and Wildlife Division is to assure compliance with laws that protect and enhance long-term health and equitable utilization of Oregon's fish and wildlife resources. To effectively enforce fish and wildlife laws in Oregon, a process titled Cooperative Enforcement Planning was developed in 1989. A formal agreement was assigned between the Oregon State Police and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to implement cooperative enforcement planning. The purpose of the plan was to prioritize enforcement protection of our fish and wildlife resources. Our fish and wildlife troopers, in collaboration with district fisheries and wildlife biologists, set enforcement priorities on a high, a medium, and a low scale. Once priorities are identified, action plans are written as to how the enforcement priority will be addressed, followed by a critique of the completed action plan that measures the outcome of the performance. Voluntary compliance is a key component to our measurability. The Fish and Wildlife Division program is made up of the Fisheries section and the Wildlife section. Each section ensures that field operations adhere to department policy, program direction, and cooperative enforcement planning. The purpose of the Fisheries section is to enforce Oregon sport and commercial fishery regulations and to protect marine resources. The Fisheries section provides industry regulation and assistance to all commercial fishery activities, charter vessels, guides, and outfitters. They coordinate the formation of policies and enforces laws and regulations affecting sport fishery. Now, Oregon Revised Statutes authorizes the division to enforce commercial fishing laws that pertain to such things as licenses and permits, vessel and gear regulations, processing facilities,
harvest quotas, seasons and areas, shellfish sanitation, vessel inspection, harvest monitoring, and deterrent patrols. The purpose of the wildlife section is to enforce the laws and regulations affecting Oregon's wildlife and to coordinate the formation of policies. Oregon by statutes again authorize the division members to enforce angling and hunting laws pertaining to licenses and tags and permits, seasons and bag limits, wildlife refuges, illegal poaching, the unlawful commercialization of fish and wildlife, deterrent patrols, protected species, threatened and endangered species, cooperative road closures, and on and on. An important component of both sections is the use of the division aircraft. The aircraft are used primarily to support the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for biological studies and research. Aerial support is also extended to fish and wildlife enforcement flights, criminal investigations, and the rapid deployment of forensic specialists, special weapons and tactics team members, and the explosive units, along with some other occasional uses. Now, last year, 55% of the flight time was specifically dedicated to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife biological studies and research. 24% of the flight time was dedicated to division enforcement flights.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Okay, are we going to, Doug, are we going to get into the details of that in phase two that we don't have to do look into it now? That's a good, the 55% and is the Department of Fish and Wildlife paying for that? I mean, are they charged for that and things like that? Are we going to get more details? We need to do that now.
We can get into that in phase two. If there's a quick response, it'd be appropriate.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, they actually pay for the plane and the fuel. So it's actually part of their funding budget for these flights.
So is it, Madam Chair? Thank you. So it's a trade-off between personnel, because you're providing the personnel and they're providing the aircraft and the fuel. Is that what we feel the state police is coming out of this fair? And
Madam Chair, Representative Wynn said, effectively, yes. They provide us the funding for the aircraft. And so when they ask for flights to monitoring and research, we, of course, respond so they don't have to privately contract for their flights. And pay that way. It's all part of the contract that we have with them.
I think we can get into that more detail.
And the contract is with whom?
Madam Chair, with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They pay for the funding that they give us supports four aircraft.
Four aircraft. And the pilots.
Yes, they support three pilots and four aircraft.
All right. Please continue.
And Madam Chair, just for your information, those aircraft are assigned to Central Point, to Salem, to Bend, and to Baker. Now, the Special Investigations Unit.
There's a question begging to be asked, Major.
The Air Force has a lot more pilots than we have airplanes. So we got more airplanes here than we got pilots.
Madam Chair, Representative Winston, the way it's broken out is we do have four pilots, but we have one pilot for each aircraft because we're spread out around the state. The one pilot is actually signed to the patrol division, so he's funded through them, but he flies an ODFW plane.
Thank you.
Please continue.
The Special Investigations Unit is responsible for conducting complex long-term investigations of individuals or groups in violation of fish and wildlife laws and regulations, with a specific emphasis on those violators that are exploiting or illegally commercializing the resources. Local, state, and federal agencies receive support from the Special Investigations Unit as covert and complex investigations are pursued. Environmental crime enforcement is enhanced with one division member assigned to the Department of Environmental Quality as a criminal investigator. This position helps coordinate investigations in Oregon between local, city, and county government, state, and federal government. Public assistance is provided and education through backcountry emergency locates, lost hunter and angler assistance, outdoor ethics training, tourist information, public talks, wildlife conservation and firearms safety, motorist assist, hunter education, boater safety education, and other things. As the population continues to increase, the demand for the consumptive use of the wildlife resources and the recreational use of the park system, the wilderness, water bodies, and public lands increase. The number of listed protected species of wildlife continues to rise. numerous fish species and the complex seasons that are set to protect them provide both recreational opportunities and economic viability for local communities. The division has built a performance measure process which ensures that the system is accountable from the trooper on the ground to the program manager. All the job-related priority activities and hours of effort that are expended doing these activities are tabulated on a bi-monthly basis. Now, that accounting includes such things as time spent planning, meeting with partner agencies, and enforcing the rules and laws. The time is then specified to a particular priority as well as matched to the management unit or the body of water that's involved. The number of contacts with the public are recorded and all non-compliance is documented. All of this information is documented in what the department refers to as the Broslin Report. This tracking system measures voluntary compliance in every wildlife unit and watershed in Oregon. Now, Oregon Benchmark 85A monitors the performance of native wild salmon and steelhead that are classified as healthy. The division has one formal performance measure that directly links to this benchmark 85A. It quantifies the percent of anglers who are angling in compliance with the rules and laws associated with salmon and steelhead harvest. The 2003 and 2004 salmon and steelhead compliance rates were 87.6% and 89.1% respectively, and this exceeded a performance target of 85%. You can refer to page 26 of your handout for a graph showing the progress of that performance measure. Now, through the Cooperative Enforcement Plan and the Broslin Report, compliance numbers are assessed and evaluated, and troopers, along with local biologists and partners, structure action plans for the next season. These action plans are carried out in the best interest for survival of the fish and wildlife resource. The commercial fisheries program of the fisheries section is measured by, again, statewide voluntary compliance, number of illegal fish which has been seized, and the number of contacts made with the commercial fish industry. Totals for 2003 and 2004 indicate that the average statewide compliance rate during that time was 86.9%. Over 19,000 hours were directed toward commercial fisheries and shellfish enforcement during that period. The sport angling program is measured by voluntary compliance of angling laws and the numbers of anglers that are contacted. Sport angling compliance rate for 2003-2004 averaged 87.7%. Division members issued well over 7,300 angling violation citations during 03-04. Sport angling compliance for 03 and 04 averaged 93.2%. Each percentage point of noncompliance relates to about $200,000 of lost revenue per year to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife due to people not purchasing licenses and tags. About 63,700 hours were directed toward sport angling enforcement. The wildlife program is measured by statewide compliance of wildlife laws, the number of contacts made, the contacts not in compliance with the law, and the number of illegally taken animals. For 2003-2004, the overall compliance rate for big game species in Oregon was 85.6%. Over 2,800 hunting violation, misdemeanor, and felony citations were issued during that time period. Approximately 71,500 hours were directed toward protection of big game species, with a total of over 88,000 focused on all hunting in Oregon. The division members issued almost 13,000 fish and wildlife citations and more than 34,000 warnings during 2003 and 2004. Now, the Marine Board is measured by subscribing to the Oregon State Marine Board's performance measures. We follow their objectives and enforcing boating safety-related rules and laws. Performance is measured by the number of hours and activities devoted to Marine Board safety and education. During the fiscal year 2003-2004, the division was under contract to provide 12,986 hours of Marine Board enforcement. The division actually exceeded that commitment by working more than 14,800 hours. We conducted more than 13,900 vote examinations that resulted in more than 270 citations and over 1,700 warnings. And that concludes my testimony regarding Fish and Wildlife Division, unless there are additional questions.
Mr. Wilson, then Representative Hansen.
I'll go with him first.
Representative Hansen.
It looks like it's relatively consistent, 13-15% non-compliance on kind of all the categories. How is there any kind of a guess of how much of that would be really willful and how much of it is based on ignorance or misunderstanding of the rules and regulations?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there is a factor in there that, you know, the covert factor. In other words, we're most of the time, most of our patrols are in uniform, and they're in a pickup, and they're visible. You know, that's one of our deterrents that we try to do is make ourselves visible so people comply with the laws. And so we have done studies in the past, putting people in the same area covertly to see what they do when they think they're not being watched, to see what the compliance rate is. We haven't done that recently. It's been probably 6 years since we've done that, but we're looking at doing that in the future. But you're right. What this is based on basically is overt patrols that are they're based on contacts, and so and by species. So. What people do when we're not there, we don't know. And so best way to do that is do a covert operation. And that's what we're thinking about doing to see if that's how close we are to a uniform patrol.
Well, that doesn't quite get to my question. Maybe, but whether that 15% lack of compliance is based on ignorance or not being able to understand what the rules are, or whether people are willfully violating.
Well, Madam Chair,
they're willfully violating.
Well, I think it's a combination of all of them. I think you have those folks out there. That's where you see the large number of warnings. People that really didn't understand or don't know what the regulations are. And, of course, one of our reasons for being there is to educate the public. And if we can gain voluntary compliance through a warning rather than a citation and achieve the same goal, that's what we look to do. And so I think it's a combination.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As it relates to the Marine Board or the boating regulations and so on, kind of a two-part question. The first is, who or how do you decide which bodies of water you're going to be on versus the county marine patrols and so forth? I mean, where does that turf discussion originate, and how do you come to a consensus on that? And secondly, it just strikes me that if we need patrol officers, are they better served doing boating inspections or doing patrol? I mean, it seems like a boating inspection could be done by somebody at the dock, you know, one trained person at the dock. I don't know. I have that question in my mind about, does a full-blown officer need to be doing boating inspection?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, what we try to do is we coordinate with the local counties. So, for example, in every office where they have a marine deputy, we try to ensure that we're not in the same place at the same time. So it's up to the officers individually to coordinate with the marine deputies. Our officers, by and large, for the most part, are out there. They do their boating checks and their boat inspections at the same time as they're enforcing the wildlife laws. So when they're out there checking, say even for duck hunters, when they come in, or they're out there and they're boating, or they're out there fishing, that's where most of our Marine Board hours come in, is they're not so much targeting the splash and giggle crowd as they are the recreational crowd that are out there hunting and fishing. So it's not more or less an overlap. The Marine deputies, by and large, they check more of the recreationalist, and we check more of the hunting and angling folks. So a lot of times it's different streams.
Can I follow up? I'm going to use Odell Lake because it happens to be a place that I go. You see the county folks there, and I think I'm correct in saying they're doing boating inspection and they're doing fish and game regulation. So So how do you, I mean, how do you pass that piece of the work to them? I mean, you call up and say, Klamath County, you guys take Odell Lake and you do the fish part there, and we'll still patrol and do game, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it goes by area by area. I'm not really familiar with Odell Lake, but we can use any lake or body of water as far as that's concerned. The way it works is that through the cooperative enforcement planning with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, we set down a criteria as far as what a high, medium, and low priority is. If there's not a, for example, let's use Roseburg for an example in the South Umpqua River. When you've got 50 fish that are, that are listed and going up the South Umpqua River up Yellow Creek and need protection, then rather than going down, say, to one of the other lakes or that Amaker Park, checking the recreationalist that's just down there fishing off the dock, we're going to spend our time protecting that resource rather than a put-and-take fishery. So many times you won't find us, you'll find us in those areas protecting our resource as well as checking boaters. We kind of two birds with one stone. And sometimes there is an overlap. When there is, usually what we do is we ask that officer in the county, well, let's just jump in together today and let's make a dual patrol.
Madam Chair, I would like to say that those are contracted services with the Green Board. They actually contracted and paid for almost 13,000 hours of service.
To the state police.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
Do they also contract to the counties then?
Madam Chair, yes, they Representative Hanna, yes, they do.
Did you have a further question?
No, that helps.
Okay. Mr. Wilson.
I just wanted to, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the co-chairs had taken a look at this performance measure, and they would like the subcommittee to explore maybe a broader performance measure, since this one's limited to some selected fish species, maybe one broader for fish, and then also introduce one for the wildlife side of it. And I do know, and this is in a division that has lots of data, so there should be no problem. You already heard them when he went through his presentation about some of those measures that are going on already, but to elevate those to a formal performance measure is something the co-chairs want you to take a look at. A couple other things. They talked a little. We didn't talk so much about funding sources in this phase, but this division is different than the others in a sense that the primary source of revenue here is ODFW, Official Wildlife Agency, from the hunting and fishing licensing fees that flow here for enforcement purposes. There are also lottery ballot measure 66 lottery funds that flow into this agency. For enforcement and making sure that habitat is kept up. There's also what traditionally has been general fund, but now is line game, just like the patrol is in here. These Fish and Wildlife Enforcement officers are also sworn troopers. They go through very similar training as every other trooper, or the same, excuse me. So they are out there also as a law enforcement entity, not just doing fish and game enforcement. They're available to pull over a driver, respond to accidents, and all the other things. So keep that in mind when we go through the budget and the work session that those are not eligible uses for the ODFW, or Fish and Wildlife, funds of the ballot measure 66. So they either have to be billed to something like the patrol division or maintain a small amount of the more what fungible general fund or line game lottery funds in this division for that purpose. In many areas of the state, they will be the closest law enforcement person, let's say in eastern Oregon, they may be the closest person to halfway, including the county or other parts of the state police. So they do also play a very important role.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Wilson. In, I guess, the divvying up of Measure $66 between law enforcement in this budget and salmon recovery dollars and Park Bureau, well, all of the various things that are, that are legitimate uses of Measure $66. Obviously, the Public Safety Committee doesn't get to make all those choices. How what's the process for dividing that pie?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, actually, I'm going to plead ignorance because I really don't know, and I can get back to you on the no statutory, is it constitutionally, I guess, there are divisions between capital and staffing costs or other costs, and if Linda, if you know, help me along here, because I know you've done natural resources in the past also.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I can add a little to this because I was with, I had Fish and Wildlife at the beginning of the Measure 66 allocations. 65% or more of the funding needs to be spent on capital expenditures. 35% or less would be on operations or administration, people, that sort of thing. So that's the beginning guideline. There's also constitutional provision for using some of the funding for land acquisition. And, of course, it is the Natural Resources Subcommittee that pretty much makes a determination of where those dollars go, including the ones that come to state police.
Madam Chair, can we follow up on that? Can you, either one of you, because the question then, do these funds, are these the ones that show up in the LF section? Is that when we're looking at Fish and Wildlife, the $6 million for the fish and the $4 million for Criminal Patrol? Is that the section that those funds are coming in through? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, those both include both the ballot measure 66 funds, as well as in the governor's budget there are what for are loosely defined as the line game lottery funds, which have traditionally been general fund, but in the governor's budget there are lottery funds flowing for those general purpose duties that I mentioned. So there's probably a combination in the
out of that $10 million combined, those are 66 and lottery.
I would guess so. And I think approximately $4 million are line game, for lack of better terminology,
okay,
and the remainder are ballot measure 60s. We can get the exact amount.
Okay, well, just so we kind of know where they're coming from. Yeah. Thank you.
I'd like a clarification on page 21. At the top of the page, it's captioned service delivery, and then indicates public assistance and education are provided through. And these functions are all related to Fish and Wildlife Division officers. That's how I'm reading the list.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Not all of these, to my reading, I would consider to be law enforcement related. Give me more information, for example, on tourist information, which is bulleted.
Well, Madam Chair, tourist information would be when you're dealing with the public during enforcement. Oftentimes you are encountered by the public or maybe the person that you're contacting just asks for information. So we provide that information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we can continue.
That concludes the testimony for the Fish and Wildlife Division.
And batting next.
Madam Chair, with your permission, if I could invite Lieutenant Gary Miller to come sit with me as we proceed with the Patrol Division.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
For the good of the committee, Doug, is this the way Washington State, California, do they handle these responsibilities in marine loading and licensing? Is that handled through the state police or is that through their Fish and Wildlife or Department? I think we're all having some misunderstanding questions. We're not questioning the dedication and all the need, but this organization.
I think I'll have the department, because I'm not sure exactly. I know Idaho is part of the Fish and Game Department. I think California is the same.
Yeah,
but
Madam Chair, Representative Winston, it's only two states out of the 50 where the Fish and Wildlife Division, by statute, is to enforce the Fish and Wildlife laws, and that's Alaska and Oregon. The rest of them have a separate, a conservation officer or game wardens as part of their management.
But follow up to that, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
But don't we have county officers that do that, too? Don't we have a, like you're saying, in Alaska and the other state that has that Are you saying Alaska and Oregon's the only ones that do it like this?
That's correct, sir.
And the other ones, okay.
The other ones have state employees, or, but they're part of their fish and game department or
you
the natural
resources. You use the term
conservation.
Conservation, yeah. But don't the counties also have conservation officers enforce some things, or is it just a county sheriff's office?
Madam Chair, Representative, you mean in this state, sir?
Yes, sir.
No, we're the only one by law.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess that begs another question, which is, have there been discussions in the recent past or the past about reconfiguring those functions, the fish and wildlife functions, and separating them out from parole and putting fish and wildlife someplace else?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any.
Representative Wisner?
I think it's a good question, Madam Chair, because, I mean, things that we're looking at, and we're both Representative Hannah and I are new, and we're just asking questions, because some of this doesn't, you know, and it does make sense to the people in the field, but we're also looking at a big training requirement, mm-hmm. and we're going to be talking about that in detail. And you know, some of these people, I'm not sure, you know, I'll need to dig in more, and with your help, understand why some of these positions would have to go through your 16-week or your 22-week training to perform some of these responsibilities. And again, we're not questioning at all your dedication and commitment and all that, but we're just looking at we have to make some tough decisions of, you know, how can we do this and do it better and still provide the services to the citizens. Thank you, Swat.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate you putting a frame around the question I posed. Okay, we have our next batter, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Lieutenant Gary Miller. I'm the Assistant Director of Patrol Services Division for the Oregon State Police.
Good afternoon, Lieutenant Miller.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving forward with the Patrol Division, the Governor's recommended budget provides for 329 full-time patrol troopers assigned to various locations statewide. And again, there is an organizational chart at the back of your numbered pages. One of the organizational charts actually shows a listing of the area commands and actual work sites that are divided into the three regions as I previously described.
And that's after page 52 of 52 toward the back.
The Patrol Services Division provides a uniform presence and law enforcement services throughout the state with the primary responsibility of two things: crash reduction and crime reduction on over 8,000 miles of state and interstate highways. Troopers respond to emergency calls for service. They augment and support local law enforcement in accordance with cooperative policing agreements. They help meet the needs of the public for criminal investigation and transportation safety needs. Last year, the division responded to more than 11,000 requests for assistance from city and county law enforcement agencies. Now, the division members enforce the Motor Vehicle Code, Motor Carrier Regulations, the Criminal Code, and Fish and Wildlife Laws. They also conduct criminal investigations, crash investigation analysis, drug driver impairment recognition. They provide emergency assistance to motorists, and they are the primary pool of personnel for our Special Weapons and Tactics Team, our Mobile Response Teams, and our Disaster Response Teams. The goal of the Patrol Services Division is to make Oregon's state interstate highways safer. Now, to achieve the strategic goals of crash and crime reduction, the division has developed 7 priority enforcement programs. In the area of crash reduction, they are traffic enforcement and motorist assistance. This is what you would typically see in a marked patrol car. Impaired driving enforcement, commercial vehicle enforcement, occupant protection enforcement, which relates to seatbelt and child restraints, and highway work zone enforcement. In the area of crime reduction, they are what we refer to as criminal apprehension through patrol enforcement and juvenile crime enforcement, and I will talk about these in further detail as we go along. To maximize our efforts in these areas, the division has 7 priority support programs
which enhance and improve overall service delivery. Now, the support programs are collision reconstruction, drug evaluation classification, which is also commonly referred to as the drug recognition expert program, motorcycle patrol, aircraft patrol, our aggressive driving enforcement program, our narcotics canine program, and the tow program. To address transportation safety and crime concerns, each area command and worksite develops and implements tactical plans that are directed toward these division programs. The plans are developed in accordance with local cooperative policing agreements, and they prioritize problem areas through statistical information and public input. Now, these local plans incorporate such things as education, engineering, enforcement, and evaluation. The division has established four performance measures that reflect the mission of the department to develop, promote, and maintain protection of people, property, and the natural resources of the state. Now, these performance measures are directly linked to five Oregon benchmarks: infant mortality, premature mortality, crime rate, juvenile crime, and cooperative policing. The first two performance measures are the number of crashes per 1 million miles traveled on state and interstate highways, the number of fatal crashes per 100 million miles traveled on state and interstate highways. Now, the data for these two measures are tracked by the Oregon Department of Transportation, and they match with federal standards used by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The third performance measure is the percentage of arrests versus the total reported crimes on rural interstate highways and state property. There's a graph on page 10 that indicates the number of crimes reported to the division versus the number of arrests out of these reported crimes. Now, these numbers do not reflect such things as warrant arrests or driving under the influence of intoxicant arrests. Data for 2003 and 2004 is currently not available due to a fund reduction to the law enforcement data system. So the last data from 2002 indicates that the arrest rate of 94.34% exceeded the target rate of 92.86%. The last performance measure is the number of people killed on the rural and interstate highways. Crash data continues to reveal that the majority of the serious injury and fatal crashes are directly related to three things: high speeds, failure to use occupant restraints, and driving under the influence of intoxicating substances. Last year alone, the division investigated almost 7,000 motor vehicle crashes. Now, over the past several years, traffic deaths on rural state, when I say that, I'm referring to those roads that are outside the incorporated city limits. So traffic deaths on rural state and interstate highways have held steady at about 44% to 47% of the statewide totals. In 2003, for example, 227 people were killed on rural state and interstate highways. This is an increase of 24 fatalities, or 12.1%. There is a graph on page 4 of your handout that shows the measure. The 2003 crash rate for rural state and interstate highways increased from 0.59 to 0.63 crashes per 1 million miles of vehicle travel. That's a 6.7 increase, and there is a graph on page 5 of your handout that shows that. Now, the 2003 fatal crash rate on rural state and interstate highways increased from 1.73 to 1.89 per 100 million miles traveled. This is an 8.5% increase, and there is a refer to the upper chart on page 6 of your handout. Now, 2003 data indicates that 44%.
Major, we have a question for you, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why the change from per 1 million miles traveled in the first measure to per 100 million miles traveled on the second? I mean, you're still measuring crashes, and why did we change the measurement?
It has to do with the statistical numbering system. Would you like to address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, there's so much fewer fatals per million miles, that the number would be, like a .00075, and it would be inconsistent as a measurable to the other number. So it's proportionally related to provide a number that's similar to the crash rate number of 0.59 to 0.63. So again, it's just a statistical change on that. I'm not a statistician, and I can't tell you precisely how it works, but that's the reasoning behind it.
Well, follow up. In my way of thinking, it's precisely that. It makes the decimal closer, but it doesn't really make it more crashes. You know what I mean? It makes it statistically, you can look at it and say they're both close to whatever the percentage is, but you've gone times 100. It's times 100. You know, 100 million miles versus a million miles. I don't know. I just wonder. I don't know why they would do it. I don't quite see the significance for making that, except it makes the number comparable, but it's no more crashes. That's just a comment. Let it go.
These are also national, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
National measures that the U.S. DOT set, so I think they're probably forced to use it to keep standard across all the whole country.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair had a problem understanding this issue this morning on performance measure, and I'm having, could you please explain to me, it's probably me only, but what are you saying here? What is this data telling us on page 4, over the past several years, 44 to 47% of the accidents happening on rural and interstate highways? I mean, no, is that saying we need to patrol those more? Is that saying that your state police is keeping that from going to 6? I don't understand what's the report? What's the information telling us?
Madam Chair and Representative Woodson, if I can just continue through the next page, I believe I'll answer that question.
Thank you.
The 2003 data indicates that 44% of all traffic deaths occurred on rural state and interstate highways. The performance measures targeted reductions in all areas, but data shows increases in all areas. The bottom line is the goal of making Oregon highways safer did not improve and, in fact, worsened during 2003. Now, complete 2004 data is not yet available for analysis. The increase in highway deaths on rural state and interstate highways in 2003 may be partially attributed to the reduction of the division personnel that we took in February of 2003. There is currently not one patrol office in the state that is staffed 24 hours. You might find it troubling that Oregon was only one of two states in the entire nation that increased in the number of fatalities during 2003. Traffic fatalities are currently up 45% from last year at this time. Our performance objectives were established during prior biennia when the patrol division had an authorized strength of 461 members. Now,
could we stop there? Because I want you to be clear. I want to be clear in my understanding of what you are implying about the reason for the increase in crashes. There has been an increase in crashes over a specified period of time because.
I don't know, Madam Chair, that we can answer that question specifically. I just find it interesting that there was a correlation to the increase and the reduction in personnel. I'm not implying that that was the reason.
When we look at what the cause was for some of those crashes, what you have listed in your text, fatal crashes directly related to high speed, that's one. Failure to use occupant restraints, that's another. Driving under the influence of intoxicating circumstances, that's a short list. There must be other causes. Driving with a cell phone comes to mind.
Yes, Madam Chair, but the majority, I will go further in some of the data that supports that, shows that these are the primary factors.
And you do go further to say failure to drive on the right side of the highway, predominant primary factor in rural non-interstate highway traffic crashes. Representative Hannah.
We promise to have fun with this. That's all the Australians here on the phone side.
Okay.
Please continue.
2002 survey showed that Oregon has less than half the national average number of troopers per 100,000 population, 9.47 as compared to 18.35 per 100,000. Now, these factors significantly contributed to the division's inability to meet target performance measures. In 2003, enforcement efforts and activity levels decreased proportionally with our patrol reductions. Division members arrested almost 7,000 impaired drivers during 2002 as compared to 4,793 in 2003. This was a 31% reduction in arrests. Preliminary data for 2004 indicates that there were 4,095 driving influence arrests, which is a 41% decrease from 2002.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry again, too, but
no problem.
Those were good comments, Major, but the number, because I've worked with issues with how many officers per population and things like that, and you gave us that, but that's not in our text, the number of officers per mile or whatever you use that statistic. Can we get that number later?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisden, I can provide a sheet that lists the national
good
averages, all that data.
Thank you.
We'll do that. Now, data from 2004 indicates that overall statewide fatalities decreased by 13% from 2003. However, data for the rural state interstate highway comparison will not be available until about mid-year. And excessive speed continues to be a problem in Oregon in relationship to highway deaths. The Oregon Department of Transportation data for 2001 indicates that excessive speed was a contributing factor in about 36% of all fatal crashes. Our own crash reconstruction cause analysis data indicates that about 40% of the fatal crashes investigated by our troopers involved excessive speed. The division's collision reconstruction program works very closely with the criminal justice agencies throughout the state in crash cause analysis. The program also works with the Department of Transportation in identifying high crash areas on rural state and interstate highways. In 2003, 39 division reconstructionists investigated and or reviewed 269 fatal crashes, of which they personally investigated 58 of those fatal crashes. And then they provided assistance to an additional 27 fatal crash investigations. The division coordinates and mandates the state's Drug Evaluation Classification Program. This is the Drug Recognition Expert Program, which trains police officers as drug recognition experts. There are currently 201 active drug recognition experts in the state, of which 52 currently are employed by the department.
May I stop you there, Major? So the state police provide their own drug recognition training as opposed to that training happening at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training?
Madam Chair, this is certification training that is conducted, and currently the department hosts that program in cooperation with the Department of Transportation.
Yes, it was my reason.
So the question, my question would be, is that training happening through the department's training division, the state police training division?
Would you like to address that?
Madam Chair, currently the way training works is it's done cooperatively throughout the state with all agencies through DPSST. Oregon Department of Transportation provides training dollars and dollars for that program, and it's currently coordinated by Sergeant Tim Plummer, one of the members in the patrol division. So in reality, it's many people working together to provide that training to all officers in the state, and it's usually conducted through the Academy at Monmouth. And then this year, in trying to improve the numbers of DREs out in the field. There's actually a training session being coordinated and sponsored by the Oregon Department of Transportation for all agencies, and then the Oregon State Police will host the same type of session in October for all agencies in the state to improve the number of DREs out in the field.
DREs, I missed.
The drug recognition experts.
Okay. So it is based at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and officers from around the state participate with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and you're just one of those agencies that participate with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and it's all paid for by the Department of Transportation.
Madam Chair, if I may, the International Association of Chiefs of Police sponsors the Drug Evaluation Classification Program through the NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Those dollars come to the state through the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Transportation Safety Division, Deputy Director Troy Costellis' shop. Those funds are distributed through many law enforcement agencies and right now through their program with the Department of State Police to fund and train all the people in city and county agencies. There is an affiliation with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. What exactly it is, I can't tell you right now, but I can certainly get back to you with that information. But in reality, it's many organizations working together to provide the service with federal dollars.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is not basic training that's received at the Academy. This is 80 hours of additional training that is not mandatory, that is provided for those officers across the state that desire to enhance their ability to detect the drug-impaired driver. Now, enhancing this drug impairment detection skills has resulted in about a 150% increase in drug driving arrests since 1995. I can give a personal example. When I was a station commander in patrol in the Central Point area, one out of four arrests in Josephine County were for driving under the influence of a substance other than alcohol, and most typically that was marijuana and methamphetamine. And one out of five arrests in Jackson County or Medford Central Point was for driving under the influence of a substance other than alcohol. In 2003, there were almost 1,400 evaluations conducted on suspected drug-impaired drivers in Oregon. That's about a 14% increase over 2002. The department members conducted about 37% of those drug recognition examinations statewide. Now, troopers within the division are trained as commercial vehicle enforcement inspectors, and they work very closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation Motor Carrier Enforcement Team. In 2003, troopers inspected over 15,600 commercial vehicles, and in 2004, we inspected over 18,000 commercial vehicles. The 2004 commercial vehicle crash rate crash data analysis is yet to be completed, so we're unable to determine really the impact on the increased inspections that was conducted by division members. The division has a number of troopers specially trained in the area.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hannah?
I'm sorry, I think we're going to go past this, and I have a couple questions here.
That's just fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To be trained as a commercial vehicle enforcement inspector, what's the training?
Madam Chair and Representative Hannah, there is 40 hours of training that is provided by the Department of Transportation Motor Carrier Enforcement that certifies our individuals to be level 2 truck inspectors.
Per officer, 40 hours per officer. And then how long does it take to do a truck inspection?
Madam Chair and Representative Hannah, that can be as short as 15 minutes, depending upon what they encounter, up to a half hour, 45 minutes, or maybe an hour, depending upon the types of violations that they may see.
May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
when I looked at that, I thought, that's an impressive number of inspections. But when you do the math, it's also a bunch of time. And I kind of come back to this thought as I did with the boating inspections. And you know, you didn't answer the question specifically to the decrease on patrol to the rural highway, but I'll just read from your book. The increase in highway deaths on rural state and highways, interstate highways in 2003 may be partially attributed to the reduction in the division's personnel. So you didn't answer it quite that way, but your book says that. Yet, if we have officers doing truck inspections that we're taking 329 officers and training them with 40 hours of training, we're taking anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour to do an inspection. And if you look back at your statistics about where the crashes are coming from, it's related to high speed, failure to use occupant restraints, driving under the influence, and some of those could be to do with trucking or commercial vehicles, but they're not mentioned as a specific type. I just wonder why we don't have this type of inspection being done at an ODOT at the way station by a trained mechanic rather than an officer.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, that does take place, but also I think it's important to understand that we are under contract again, and I believe that the last legislature shifted funds to provide for 15 positions?
Mr. Wilson?
The major is right, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. In the efforts last year to preserve the number of positions in the patrol division, one of the actions was to dedicate more of that DOT funding for truck inspections into the state police. It kept a number of troopers, but unfortunately it also is a dedicated source of revenue. And so, you know, they're on the highway, but they're also expected to do a certain degree of truck inspections to meet that funding stream. So really, the answer to the question is funding stream.
May I follow up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Because Doug brings up a good point. And again, I mean, I bring a calculator to do this, and I don't mean to be picky, but I'm here to ask the question. I mean, if you think about that, 18,000 inspections, you had to have every officer do nearly 60 of those, if I do the math right. That seems like a lot of officers on the side of the road, again, doing a mechanical service rather than a patrol job. And I just have a bunch of questions around that.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I think there's some really important things to understand here. First of all, it's the amount of imported and exported goods that are moved across the state and interstate highway system. One of the primary things that our troopers do is they take a look at logbook hours during their routine contacts when they make probable cause stops, which is as a result of a violation. We stop. Every one of those trucks were stopped and inspected as a result of a violation that they committed.
That's an excellent and very important piece of information, that these are probable cause stops. This is not just about stopping trucks. And
That's right, Madam Chair, is that these trucks are stopped for speeding, for falling too close, for making illegal lane changes, and for other violations. And during the course of their contact, they take a look at what is the next most important thing, and that has to do with the driver hours that are being used, because fatigued drivers has a significant impact upon the commercial crash rate. So this is a very important service that our troopers are providing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you then make sure to provide us with the prior year's data about commercial vehicle crash rate? And could you also provide us, if the state police provided over 18,000 inspections, how many in comparison were done at a scales when they just put the sign up and say, slide over, we're going to do a truck check here by the Waymaster folks or ODOT? Madam Chair, in terms of comparison, I'd like to understand, does the state police do more of this than the other agency?
Madam Chair and Representative, we can provide that information. I can tell you, based on my own experience, that the vast minority of inspections are done at actual inspection stations. They're done during routine contacts.
One last thing here. Doug, could you provide to us then the trail on the funding to this so that we understand? I mean, I'm all about having troopers on the road. So it's not that. It's just that I'm not sure we need to have you doing the mechanical service. And that's, I think there's a big difference here between checking somebody's logbook or pulling them over for another infraction versus rolling around under the truck doing a brake inspection type commercial vehicle inspection. That's the distinction I'd like to understand better, is who's performing that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, at one time we had a number of our employees who were level one truck inspectors who went much more in depth into the mechanical aspects of an inspection. We have very few now, and the majority of our inspections relate to registration, licensing, logbooks, and the initial inspection.
We're at 3 o'clock. Members, do you want to continue for a couple more minutes to get your an additional question in?
Well, I was going to suggest, Madam Chair, to the major, and I think one thing would be helpful, too, because I've done a ride-along. I know how you use those stops for probable cause to find things. Could you tell us some of the successes you've had in finding, you know, illegal drugs, whatever, in some of those inspections? I think that would be just help to justify them.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Also, Major, tomorrow, if you could, you touch on the LEDs issue just briefly in your testimony. I thought you said something about you're inhibited in the kind of information you can currently get from LEDs because there was a decrease in funding, or I didn't totally understand what you were saying, and I...
Yes, it related to some of the data that was necessary.
Would you come back to us tomorrow and talk about that piece?
Yes, ma'am.
The LEDs piece. I also want to acknowledge that the superintendent is back with us in the back of the room, and we just want to say welcome. It's glad to see you. We're glad to see you looking better, and we hope feeling better.
Thank you.
I'm glad that you're above ground. We'll see you tomorrow, too.
I have a fitness plan.